Hi to Theo Fidoi. I'm Fletcher from amindforlanguage.com, and you're listening to Greeking Out, a podcast for ancient and Koine Greek learners full of tools, tips, and possibly tirades on learning Greek using comprehension-based methods. If that isn't familiar to you, check out episode 0, The Manifesto, for more info. In this episode, I want to talk about memory techniques for language learning, specifically for ancient Greek. But the principles are broadly applicable to other languages as well. And there's an important difference here between using techniques for learning versus using them for, say, competition or for presentations and things. And that'll inform a bit how we do it. But a lot of my thinking about memory techniques has been informed by Anthony Métivier, who you can find at the Magnetic Memory Method, Matthias Ribbing, who is a little bit harder to find, is a Swedish memory champion, but he's also focused on learning. He and another guy have written a book called Maths Unwrapped, I believe, talking about how to apply visual imagery to learning mathematics, which I think we can cross-apply a lot of that to what we do. And then also Len Kelly, who's an Australian PhD and researcher, who has written a lot on the traditional uses of memory techniques in oral cultures down through time, which is a fascinating book. She has a couple of them. I especially recommend Memory Craft, which talks about a lot of different techniques and how to use them, again, for learning and education. You could also look up books such as The Memory Palace of Matteo Ricci, which talks about a Jesuit missionary's use of memory techniques in China and learning Chinese. Yeah, there's many other books available, but primarily Lynn Kelly and Matthias Ribbing and Anthony Métivier have kind of shaped a lot of what I'll say, so I refer you to them for more information. So where does memorization fit into comprehensible input-based methods for learning ancient Greek? I think it fits in as ways to make texts more comprehensible. And I think we can do this in two ways, memorizing grammar and paradigms, and also in memorizing vocabulary. Paul Nation points out that, you know, explicit study of language is one of the four strands of language learning. So this fits in with that model. And using memory techniques can make it a lot more enjoyable than simply repeating information over and over again. Okay, so how does it work? Memory is essentially a response to a stimulus. So as when we recall something, there's a stimulus that causes us to bring it back. And in our brain, those are made by connections between neurons. So the more connections to something, the stronger those connections, the more readily we can remember something. So for vocabulary in our native language, it's such strong connections, we can use it very, very easily. For new vocabulary in ancient Greek, not so much. So the point of all of these techniques is to provide a hook that, and to strengthen these mental connections, you know, between these neurons so that we can find the information more easily. And once those connections have been built, we no longer need the imagery. So mnemonics really, for us, are only a stepping stone. So what's the principle of this imagery? It's nice if it can be large. When we're imagining something, if it's three dimensions, you know, concrete, something that has definable limits, I think that helps. As I try to craft things, I think about what is easily to be confused. So a bunch of people that look the same would be difficult mnemonics for me. But if someone's got strong associations, you know, be they unique physically or strong emotional associations, or I know a lot about that person, then I think that's useful for mnemonic imagery. One thing Lynn Kelly points out, and I think Métivier has picked up as well, is the idea of using a visual alphabet, which I think is incredibly useful for us and perhaps one of the most powerful tools we have in our mnemonic toolkit. And that is the idea that every letter of the alphabet has a character associated with it. And I would add to that an action or an object. Well, I'd add to that an object. So, for example, with Greek, this is helpful because we have different vowels that, depending on your pronunciation scheme, could sound similar, but we want to keep distinct, especially for memorizing paradigms. So, for example, we might use someone that starts with A for alpha. So, for me, I would probably use Abraham Lincoln, and I want an object that goes with that. And you could do this two different ways. You could just pick something that sounds like it. So I think of an axe, but you could get really creative and grab something from ancient Greek that starts with an alpha if you wanted. Up to you. So for alpha, I might have, you know, Abraham Lincoln. For beta, I might have Bugs Bunny. you know, for Kappa, Captain Kirk from Star Trek, and Captain Kirk and a kite. So if I need an object instead of a person, I could use a kite. And the idea is that as we're memorizing things, we can that start with different letters, we can pull from this alphabet to get us started. So if we wanted to memorize vocabulary using this visual alphabet, we might look at what it starts with. So I have a list of vocabulary from Farr's Homeric Greek Grammar. And here I have the word ereo, which is to ask. So that starts with an epsilon. So I'm going to just use what I normally use for like an English E there. So for me, that's going to be Elmer Fudd. So I might imagine Elmer Fudd asking something to someone. I can visually build that into the story. Now, I think it's most powerful to take lists of things and build them into stories, longer stories. I think that sticks better in my mind, I've found over the years. Anthony Metivier would recommend that for each letter of the alphabet, you create a memory palace, which I'll talk about, and store each item in there. So you're kind of creating a dictionary in his method. I think that's fine. But again, for what we're trying to do is we're trying to build, make things more comprehensive. More comprehensible. We're trying to build comprehensibility. So we don't really need to have a massive long-term storage system. And as long as we can get it from, okay, I barely know this word to, I know this word to, I can see it in a text and recognize it, we're good. So the mnemonic will eventually fall away. So I don't know that it's actually worth the effort to do all that, but that's a method he recommends and you can look it up. And it's worked well for him and some of his students. So take that as it may. But so we have ereo. To ask. The next word in the list that I didn't know at least was loimos, which means a plague. So that's an L. So that's going to be, for me, I thought of Lucio Ball. I can combine these two words into a story and say, you know, one day Elmer Fudd was walking around and he saw Lucio Ball and he asked her why she looked so sick. You know, and she said, because she was suffering with plague and Elmer Fudd was horrified. Something like that. So now I've got a short, simple story and each of my words has a character that it starts with and then you know, they're doing something that gives me the meaning. So Elmer Fudd is asking, and Lucille Ball says she has plague. One of the things that Lynn Kelly points out is that we don't have to encode this stuff perfectly. That cultures traditionally, when they've used stories or other memory devices to encode knowledge, don't have trouble separating what's supportive story from the actual information being passed down. And I found that to be true for myself. I may have to think a little bit, but I can usually get back from the silly story to the information, even if I haven't encoded each detail. So you'll notice that with ereo, I didn't bother to encode each letter. I just used the first one. Another principle I found that people say is look at what the stressed syllable. So you could do that. I still think I'm better off just with the beginning. If you really wanted to encode every letter, you'd end up with Elmer Fudd and then R, which you know we might could use... Or, you know, Roe, which maybe we could use Richard the Lionhearted or something. Or R, if I was going to use it with an object. A lot of times if I want to get multiple pieces together, I'll do person, object. So I might take Elmer Fudd and then an object that starts with R. So maybe a radio. So he's listening to the radio. And then I've got Elmer Fudd again. So maybe he's talking to a copy of himself. And then for Omicron, we need an O. Object, so, you know, maybe an orange. So Elmer Fudd's listening to a radio, and then all of a sudden, another Elmer Fudd walks up with an orange? Something like that. I don't think it's necessary, and I think it actually works better, like I said, just to go with something simple that gets us, provides just enough of a hook that our brain can hang that information on there. That's really all we're trying to do. So I personally prefer the Elmer Fudd asking Lucille Ball, who looks sick, you know, why she looks sick, and she's to respond with, oh, I contracted the plague, and then he's horrified, you know, because he's afraid he's going to get bubonic plague. That little story works, and you could do that for everything in the list. And again, notice, I came up with that on the fly. I pre-planned my list of characters, my visual alphabet. That's something you do as setup work, but just for that little story, I just invented that while recording this. And that's another point of having a pre-planned, prepared visual alphabet makes memorization much faster because you don't have to say, okay, well, what am I going to do for ereo? You just say, okay, well, it starts with an epsilon, so that's Elmer Fudd. Boom. And then what does it mean he's asking? Okay. And notice I didn't need to come up with who he's asking because I've said I'm going to combine all these vocabulary items into a story. And so I just said, well, okay, the next word is loimos, and that starts with a lambda, an L. So I'm going to use Lucille Ball. So he's asking Lucille Ball. There we go. So that's, I think that's a lot more efficient. And again, we can combine this whole list into a long story, which surprisingly memorable. I found, especially with grammar paradigms, which I'll demonstrate in that. So this brings us to the question of, okay, we've come up with a story. Well, how do we get to it? This is where a traditional memory technique, the memory palace, or the method of loci, or the Roman room, goes by many names, it's all the same thing, I think is helpful. The core idea here is that we take a space that we're familiar with, that we can easily picture and walk through in our mind, and we divide it up into stations, or loci, where we place information. So we place a visual mnemonic. So, for example, traditionally, you would take each word and build a short mnemonic story just for that word. So Elmer Fudd asking something and put that in a place, you know. So let's use a house. So for example, think of your bedroom and maybe your bedroom door. And a really simple way to do this is you can just use each of the four corners of the room. So whatever corner is closest to the door, take a second and try to visualize that. What does that look like? And then see Elmer Fudd mentally play a movie in your mind if you can. Vague is fine, doesn't need to be clear and perfect, of Elmer Fudd standing there asking. That's the method of loci. In the next corner, you'd put Lucille Ball feeling sick with a plague, and you around the room, right? And each of the places you want, four corners, you could use different objects. Like, for example, if I think of my bedroom, I could do the corner by the door, or the dresser, the next corner, the bed, the nightstand, another dresser, our closet, and then going out the door, I would go to the next room in the house, which for us would be a bathroom. One tip Anthony Metivier gives with using the memory palace is go in order around the room. So always enter a room, and work around it clockwise, for example, or, you don't want to be zigzagging across a space, because then your brain has to remember not only the information, but the order in which you're supposed to go through the room. So just pick a standard order, clockwise, counterclockwise, however you want to do it, and stick with that, and that makes this easier. So that's the memory palace. Now, if we're doing longer stories, how do we combine those two? For me, I'd think, okay, what's an object that can help me get back to this story? So it may just be the first word in the vocabulary list, and I picture the first little bit of the story physically in that space, and then when I want to review the vocab, I can just take a mental walk through the room, that we've talked about, and see the first part and like, oh yeah, that story. And then I can go through the whole story and get the different pieces. I think that's a promising way forward. So there's an example of vocabulary. And maybe with vocab, it's not as useful, but I think it probably still is. And you can combine this with flashcards, for example. So you make flashcards for these things, and then you build yourself this story. And then as you flip the flashcard, you think, oh, okay, that was in that story. And you can just go through the story until you find the answer of the flashcard. It'll probably pop into your head after a couple of repetitions anyway. You'll remember Loimos as Lucille Ball looking sick, which I think is great. You can combine that with Anki. The other cool thing about using memory techniques like this is that if you don't have your flashcards, you don't have your devices with things, you actually can still review because it's all in your head. It's in a memory palace. So you say, okay, I'm washing dishes, or I'm driving somewhere, or I'm stuck waiting in line, and you can just say, okay, walk through the palace and review the story as you put there. There we go. Okay. So that's how we can use it for vocabulary. The core with vocab generally is that you want a clue to the pronunciation or spelling, and then a clue to the meaning. So combine those two things in some way and you're good to go. That's the basic principle there. Now, I think this is really super useful for memorizing paradigms. And again, do we need to do that? Not really, but it's a useful support for making text more comprehensible, because we kind of gives our brain a mental menu of things that we might encounter in a text, especially if we're moving on from the more controlled things we'd find in beginner-focused textbooks or readers, and now we're trying to get into natural text. Like for me, it'd be really useful to know the optative paradigm, because it's not that common in the New Testament or perhaps Septuagint, where a lot of my reading has been, but it's all out there in, other Greek text. So I might want to memorize that. So how can we go about this? Well, visual alphabet to the rescue. So I'm using this story that I'll tell here to memorize the first and second declension Greek noun endings. Now, I actually know this paradigm pretty much by heart anyway, because, you know, I said it to myself so many times growing up. So this is more an illustration than me actually memorizing any new information for you. But I have been doing this with Hebrew, so I'm trying to work on my Hebrew too, and I found it to be really very helpful for refreshing information that I've largely forgotten, because I use Greek a whole lot more than Hebrew in my life. But so here's an example of a story. So nouns, things involving nouns, I try to associate with a character. And I found this is another useful technique that Anthony Mathivier calls bridging figures. They're people that go around, that show up in different stories to help remember things. He's using this primarily for pronunciation, I think. Maybe not. When I've seen him talk about it, or when I've paid it, as I remember, because I was always more focused on vocabulary, you might have someone who is your character for N that shows up in all the stories. It's essentially a visual alphabet, but in this case, I'm going to use it for grammar. So I think of N, noun starts with N, I think of Nelson Mandela. He's not in my visual alphabet, actually. I use Napoleon instead, because I think he's more easy to, you know, visually picture, whatever. But so for stories about noun paradigms or noun grammar, I'm going to have Nelson Mandela show up. And if it's a verb, I think V, makes me think of Vicini. If you've ever seen the movie The Princess Bride, he's a funny character. He's memorable. He has a unique costume, so he's easy to picture. So here's my story. So Nelson Mandela one day went with his friend Scorpion to the beach. And the beach was empty. And out in the water, they saw a narwhal playing. And then as they sat down to have their lunch, the sea urchins came up from everywhere. And the scorpion tried to grab one, and it stung. And the urchin, like, was spiky, and it hurt. And he yelled, "Ee!" And he tried to bury himself under the sand to get away from all these urchins. And then the narwhal, seeing all of this, started splashing water up all over the beach and washed all the urchins away back into the sea. And while all this is happening, a cowboy walks up and says, "Oi, hiya. You know, I own this beach, and I'm glad you're welcome to stay all you want. Would you like some oist tea?" And he said oist, not ice, because that was his accent. That's why he said oist. And so he walked over to the bar he had built there, where the goose was the bartender, and to order. And the goose says, "Today's special is carne asada." Okay. So I actually haven't followed the visual alphabet technique for all of this, but let's look at it. I'll break the story down. So, Nelson Mandela is telling me that I'm dealing with a noun, and he goes to this friend, Scorpion. Now, not the Scorpion or a Scorpion, but Scorpion. He's a character, right? Len Kelly talks about the idea of rapscallions showing up in world cultures. They go by various names, but they're characters. So when we do this visual alphabet, we want to make these people to be characters. And as they do, they kind of live in our minds and grow and pick up their own associations. As an aside, I use Henry VIII for H. And as I've been memorizing these Hebrew paradigms, he's often showing up with U's and N's, which the objects I use for that are a ukulele and a net, respectively. And it seems like just because of the relative positions of the bits in the paradigm, that Henry VIII is a music hater who's always trying to steal a ukulele and keeps constantly getting a net thrown on his head. So, and that has to do with I'm encoding NH, so net, H, you know, NH becomes net Henry VIII. That's a piece of the Cal imperfective paradigms in Hebrew. Anyway, so these characters can kind of develop their own stories and characteristics apart from what we know of them from history as you use them, which is kind of fun. But okay, so let's break back to the story about Nelson Mandela and Scorpion. So Scorpion is encoding sigma, which is the ending for nominative singular. And I'm telling this story in the traditional order for the paradigm. So masculine, feminine, neuter, nominative, genitive, dative, accusative, singular, and then plural. So that's how you would remember the story. So Scorpion sigma goes to the beach and it's empty because there's no ending added for nominative singular feminine nouns there. And he sees a narwhal encoding new, right? So sigma blank new. And they're going to eat their lunch, which is giving me their possession, the idea of dative. And urchins, ooh, the U-diphthong come up all over the beach, and the scorpion, sigma, because feminine singular is, genitive is singular, comes up and he picks up an urchin. So there's an urchin there, then the scorpion does something, then there's another urchin. That gets me that it's U, sigma, U, for the genitive paradigm for that line in the thing, in the paradigm. And it stings him, so he screams, ee, right? All three dative endings are iota there. So ee for the dative singular. And so he digs under the sand to hide. Why does he do that? Because those iotas subscript. So I've got him digging under. That's giving me not only what does the paradigm look like, how would I spell it, but it's giving me information about the grammar too. I think it's kind of cool. You know, then what happens? The narwhal starts splashing water. Well, okay, that kind of helps me see accusative means you're doing something. And so the narwhal is washing all the urchins away. Okay. Then the cowboy shows up and says, oi, hiya. Why a cowboy? Because Ohio, oi, hiya, hiya sounds kind of cowboyish to me. And that gets me, what he says gives me the oi, I, oi, or e, I, e thing. And he says he owns the beach because omega nu is the ending for all three cells on the genitive plurals. And he offers them some oist tea, but he really meant iced because it's oist, ice, oist is the dative plurals. And he goes over to the bar he has with the goose because us, omega, epsilon, sigma is not masculine accusative plural, who says their special is asada. So as, alpha, sigma is accusative plural feminine, and then just an alpha is the accusative plural neuter there. So that's kind of a silly story that gets you this paradigm. It would be pretty simple to do that for the third declension nouns as well, and for verb endings. O, is, e, omen, ette, usi. Wouldn't be that hard to come up with something for. And you could spell it out as much as you need to. So if you're trying to memorize the verb and usin, you may only need to do the u at the beginning. Maybe you need the u and the sigma. You know, as you experiment creating these stories and mnemonics, you'll realize what your brain needs. But I'm always surprised to find that it probably needs less than we think it does. You know, brains are really good at memorizing things. And I think we're really good with stories. They're entertaining. They're fun. Traditional cultures use story to pass on information. Stories, chants, rhymes, songs. Lynn Kelly talks all about this. You know, it's one of her books, I think, or maybe an interview I listened to with her. She asked the question, why do we just sing about love when traditional cultures, oral cultures, sing their knowledge? So, you know, we can create stories to help us learn these things. Songs, whatever. And again, the underlying principle behind all of this is find something to give your brain more anchors, more hooks into the information you're trying to encode. So there's an example of using mnemonics for paradigms. Now, say you wanted to use a memory palace to organize all these paradigms. Well, how could you do that? Well, we have, again, Nelson Mandela going with the scorpion. I'd probably just, going back to the example of, say, if I was using my bedroom, in one of the corners, I'd probably just have I'd probably imagine Nelson Mandela and the scorpion. Also, another way to do this that I think is actually quite helpful too is we can use objects as memory palaces, like large objects, like say a car. You know, car, you're probably familiar with your car. You could say, well, the left headlight will have this, the right headlight has that. There's something on the hood or the license plate that you go inside, driver's seat, rider's seat, front and back. You can use that as well. So I kind of like doing that for grammar for some reason. The car takes us on the journey into Greek. Maybe that's the motivation. So maybe if I could have multiple cars, or maybe this is where we take Metivier's idea of, you know, compartmentalization and say one room of my house is for noun grammar. The next room is for verbal grammar. Or maybe if you live in an apartment or whatever, or your house is not big enough, or there's a lot of grammar you want to memorize, maybe my house is for nouns, my friend's house is for verb grammar. And so we can memorize all these paradigms in places where we can know, oh, I want to remember something for nouns, I'm going to look in my house. And then I need something for verbs, I'm going to look in, you know, my friend's house. Okay, so I've rambled quite a bit, so let's recap. From my perspective, the goal of memorization in comprehensible-based methods for learning Greek, comprehensible input-based methods for learning Greek, is supporting that process of making things comprehensible. It's not to store things long-term or forever, it's just to make them accessible, more easily accessible to us as we are interacting with things, as we are interacting with texts. So if your assignment is to read a certain passage for class and you have a vocab list, make a quick story, get that vocab list in your head, provide more anchors to those things so that when you go to read it, you've got anchors, you've got faster, stronger associations with the new vocabulary. Again, this is useful if, you know, if you're in a traditional setting rather than learning on your own and you have to pass a quiz or an exam, well, you can use these techniques for that too. But I think their primary value is supporting us as our brain is trying to internalize this stuff, because as far as I understand, memorization of words and grammar does not become language in the brain. It becomes language in the brain through repeated comprehensible exposure. And so we're simply using memory techniques to make things more comprehensible that otherwise would not be. And we can do that by memorizing vocabulary and by memorizing paradigms, you know, grammar. And it doesn't just have to be the endings. Like I showed with my story, I could encode the behavior of the iota subscript by having my character, my scorpion, dig under the sand to hide. And you can do that with other things too. Like I use Nelson Mandela to say that this is a noun. With Hebrew, I have characters that show me which vowel in the triconsonantal root, or which letter in the triconsonantal root that I'm talking about, or I need to modify, because with Hebrew verbs, the affixes get shoved in between the root letters. And you could do something similar, you know, for Greek if you want to memorize, say, the square of stops, or, you know, the what sound changes happen. You could use stories like this to memorize that, like, I think is it Omicron, and Omicron becomes the U diphthong. So we could have, you know, Oscar the Grouch eating an orange and poof, it actually wasn't an orange. It was an urchin hiding inside. He gets a toothache or something like that. You know, dumb little story, but hey, maybe you'll remember that those two things become ooh now. Yeah, so memorization is supporting comprehensible input. I think that's the most useful. Also, if we spend all our time trying to memorize and remember and review these stories, we won't be making much progress on other aspects of language learning. And again, explicit language study is one of the four strands that Paul Nation talks about. So it should only probably have about a quarter of our time. So it's supporting comprehensible input. Second, the whole goal is to strengthen associations in the brain, to provide hooks that our brain can hang new information on. So however that works for you, go for it. A visual alphabet that you pre-prepare by selecting a character at least. And ideally, these characters should be relatively distinct, so they're easy to memorize. So with my list, I have a combination of real people who have strong characteristics and cartoon characters. So my Y is Yogi Bear. You know, my V is Vincent Van Gogh. I can kind of picture him, maybe his self-portrait, etc. You know, Tom the Cat, Sylvester Stallone, Richard the Lionhearted, Porky Pig, Oscar the Grouch. It's a combination of things. So visual alphabets are very helpful for creating mnemonics quickly and also developing stories with characters. When we're memorizing vocab, the idea is that we have a clue to pronunciation and a clue to meaning in the story or in the image somehow. And we can memorize paradigms this way as well. And it's useful, again, look at the information, look at how it's structured, and build your story in that way so you don't have to memorize the order of the information as well. So when we're rehearsing, when we're recalling or reviewing information in the memory palace, go through things in the same direction. As you add new information to it, add it in the next available spot, going, say, in a set direction through the house and through the rooms in the house as best you can. That really helps. So yeah, there's a lot more we could talk about. Some people, for creating these images, recommend things that are grotesque or, you know, sexualized or, you know, absurd. That can be helpful for some people. I'm not sure that works as well for me. I think just the value of a story, building things into stories, you know, longer stories, is more helpful to me. So, like I said, I'm I'm playing around with the ideas of combining vocabulary lists into one story or two stories, but generally grouping things together, because that works better for my brain to remember a story than to try to remember a bunch of individual things. And I think it's a little more fun, and I think it's easier too. So anyway, so there's my take on how you might use mnemonics in comprehensible input-based learning of ancient Greek and other languages. Eroste. Intro and outro music is Funky Thanksgiving by Admiral Bob, used with gratitude under a Creative Commons 3.0 attribution license. Track can be found at dig.ccmixer.org.